Okay. Okay, so here we go. Dear Bhante Brahmali, could you kindly speak about forgiveness? Okay. For life forgiveness, for liveness, is that what it says? Okay. The steps to take to forgive yourself and others. Thank you. Okay. Forgiveness, sure. So to be able to forgive other people or forgiving yourself, you have to understand basically that they are not really in charge. The reason why we blame others, we blame ourselves, we judge people is because we think that they are the agent, they are responsible, they shouldn't have done what they should, what they did. And that is why we cannot let go and just go beyond things. So this is always back to the same old thing, the idea of non-self, right? We are the product of our condition, of who we are. What we are is a product of our conditioning from the past, in this life and also in previous lives. And because that is what we are, and there's no kind of entity inside which is in charge, which always steers us in the right direction, then what is ultimately in charge are these cause and conditions, right? These are the things that make us do what we do. So there's very limited, often limited ability to control our lives, to do what is right and to do what is wrong. Very often we're just railroaded along according to these cause and conditions. And very often we can't do any different from what we're doing. It is said that if you become a stream entry, if you see the Dhamma fully, then you understand for the first time that this is the reality. And then it is so easy to forgive yourself afterwards because you understand that essentially you didn't have much choice. You did those things because that is what you had to do, essentially. So just understand that. Understand that people are the products of their conditioning. You can't, and so are you as well, right? The reason why you judge yourself is because you feel, I should have done better, I should have done differently. Could you really have done differently? Are you sure about that? Do you really understand yourself well enough that you could have done otherwise than what you did? You were a victim. You were a victim of your own conditioning. Just as everybody is. Everybody is basically a victim of their conditioning. And once you see people as victims rather than as agents, and you understand that even if they want to do what is right, they can't, right? They're incapable. Even though they understand that kindness is the source of happiness in their own life and the life of others, they are on tracks, right? The tracks are heading in one direction. These are the causes and conditions, and there's nothing much they can do about that. And this is why this idea of the Kalyananitta standing at the very beginning of the path is so important, because without that one condition that can kind of override the other conditions in your life, there is nothing to really give you any guidance, and you're always just following bad conditions, bad causes in your life. So it comes back to this idea of non-self. Once you understand that, it becomes much so easy to forgive, right? The more deeply you understand that, the more easy it is to forgive. People are what they are. People suffer. People don't really want to suffer. Everybody suffers, and yet they don't find the way out of that. A lot of the things that we do in life are because we want to get out of suffering. And we do all the stupid things, the silly things, to get out of suffering. We don't do what we actually need to do. And we're just continuing and on. We're continuing on like these blind people, moving on in life, just forever building up suffering. No, there's no end to it. Forever kind of perpetuating this problem. We don't know what we're doing. We're blind. If you're blind, how can you not have compassion on people? Compassion is the only answer. That's what the Buddha, he is the one, he has absolute, he's basically made of compassion. Everything he does is motivated by compassion. Everything he says, every act, every thought after his awakening is motivated by compassion. Understanding the suffering, understanding that people are blind, they don't know how to get out of that. So this is how you then forgive, right? You realize that there is nothing to be blamed, nobody to be blamed. It is impossible to blame people, impossible to blame yourself. And then when you forgive, then you let go. And then you can turn things around and you can actually have compassion instead, just like the Buddha had compassion. It takes training, right, to see things in a different way. This is a kind of very Buddhist way of looking at things. It's very different from an ordinary, worldly way of looking at things. But you can shift that, the way you see things. Gradually, you shift it and you see the world in a different way. Okay, dear Ajahn, with regard to euthanasia, you have said that in the Buddhist perspective, it is not entirely a bad thing. I understand the non-clinging to a physical body. Does ending one's life consciously interfere with one's karma? Isn't the suffering from illness or old age part of seeing things as they truly are? Okay, so let me just start with that, because I'll read the whole thing perhaps, so we'll have some overview of what's going on here. Is making this conscious choice a shortcut? Also, the stigma regarding suicide, I'm concerned that younger people might get the wrong message and feel it is okay to kill themselves if things get unbearable. Please comment on both. Much gratitude for your honest sharing. Okay, so is it consciously interfering with one's karma? Well, remember, karma is not about, you know, just allowing things to be, right? If you break your leg, you go to hospital. You don't kind of just let the leg be there and say, I interfere with my karma if I kind of fix it up, right? The fact that you have hospital care means that there is some, this is part of the human realm. It's part of your good karma of being reborn as a human, right? And it's exactly the same thing. Any suffering we have, whether it is a broken leg or a suffering, like we are terminally ill and you are suffering, if you have access to, say, euthanasia, it might just be considered part of the good karma of being reborn as a human, right? You're not really interfering with karma, you're just using the options that are available to you. And that is not interfering. You can't interfere with karma, really. If karma is going to take you a certain way, that's just going to happen regardless. So I think that is, I don't think that is the right way of looking at it. I know sometimes people make that argument, but I don't think that is necessarily correct. Isn't seeing suffering from illness or old age part of seeing things as they truly are? Yes, I think that can be true. I think that if we are able to use our suffering, our illness, our old age, if we're able to use that to grow in the Dhamma, to grow in spiritual qualities, to actually make something good out of it, then I think that's wonderful. And I think that's definitely the preferred option, right? If you commit suicide, if you end it all, then there is no growth in that, perhaps. So you have the opportunity, you can use it for growth. So please, of course, that is, of course, the best situation if you can. But there are cases, and I have met people like this on a few occasions, where they just feel completely overwhelmed, right? They feel like they're drowning in the suffering and everything. They lose their clarity of mind, their life has no quality. They're not growing in Dhamma, they feel they are declining in Dhamma, because it is just so hard. So in that sort of situation, where everything is just completely miserable, they don't feel there's anything to be gained out of life, then perhaps in that situation it might be the right thing to do, perhaps. But you're quite right. One shouldn't make these things, do it hastily. It should be done with great, after great reflection, right? Is this the right thing to do or is it not? But the point is that it is an option that in certain circumstances that are very difficult might be the right one. That's really all, I suppose. Is making this conscious choice a shortcut? It's just a choice, right? It's not a shortcut nor a long cut. The only shortcut is to make an end of samsara, right? That's really the only shortcut. There isn't any shortcuts otherwise. If you can't learn from it, probably it might be a wise thing to do. It's not a shortcut at all. Actually, it might be the best solution in certain circumstances. So, yes, you're right. Certainly, it is not to give people the idea, the message that it's okay to kill yourself. Of course, that is not really the message here. And especially if you are, if you feel really depressed and down, you try everything. You try anything that is possible to do. And, you know, suicide should not really be an option. It doesn't really help you all that much very often, because the mind you have now is the mind you carry with you into the future. And it's not really an ideal thing here. But I think that if people do commit suicide, I don't think it is right to judge them, because we don't know the situation they were in. It may have been very, very difficult. And sometimes, perhaps, it is a way out, a temporary way out, which actually works for that person. It's very hard to judge. So we do our best while we're alive. We encourage people to carry on. We tell them about this too will pass, right? We encourage them to do some good acts to boost their inner happiness so they don't have to commit suicide. Of course, all of those things we do. But then if they still decide to go ahead, I don't think it is right to judge people for that and say, we just don't know whether it's bad or good. It's very, very hard to judge. Okay. Dear Ajahn, you mentioned life is about being happy. Therefore, I started to share happiness with my loved ones instead of transferring merit to them. I had a wonderful meditation as a result of doing so. Okay, great. Is it okay to continue doing that in my meditation? Sure. If it works, if it makes you happy, if it gives rise to wholesome states, then it obviously is the right thing to do. So please do so. That's wonderful. With so many things, it's often about finding skillful means, right? And sometimes finding skillful means, it's different from person to person. We are all slightly different. Different things work for different people. And one of the things that you will find is that your way of generating happiness, your way of thinking about the world, and your way of using your wisdom, it becomes blunt after a while, right? If you do like a death contemplation, you get into a certain way of doing the death contemplation, and it may give rise to a certain amount of peace, it may give rise to a certain amount of wholesome states, right? And then after a while, it doesn't work anymore. And then you have to renew it. You have to do it slightly differently. It's like the instruments don't bite anymore because they don't have the same message for you as they had at the beginning. Then you have to change and you have to be creative. You have to do things differently. And then they start to bite again. And then they have, they actually work as they're supposed to work. So you always have to adjust a little bit, do things slightly differently, not be a creature of too much habit. If it becomes too habitual, you just go into the same state, you don't really get anywhere. You always have to reflect, to be asking questions. Is it working? Am I getting where? Am I getting the results I'm supposed to get? If not, why not, right? What is hindering me? What is stopping me? The path of inquiry is such an important aspect of the Buddhist teachings. Always inquiring, how can we move forward on this path? It is so important. And if you don't do that, you end up plateauing and you just don't go anywhere because you're not really asking the questions that you need to ask. That's good. It's wonderful that you have found your own little way. Please keep doing that and see see how things go. And if you share your happiness with them, I'm sure they will be, that very likely they will be very happy when you do that. Okay. Dear Ajahn, my cow needs to be flogged. Okay. Right. Okay. Fair enough. How does one harness or secure the stick to at the cow? Wisdom is always present mostly because awareness, mindfulness is present. Okay, but not so in the execution. Somehow habit takes over. Mindfulness is on the leave. Where is the stick? Gone AWOL. Okay. Thank you for your inspiration. It's much better. Okay. So wisdom is always present in my planning, mostly. But then in the execution, it somehow disappears. Okay. So maybe what is missing there, as you say, perhaps mindfulness isn't strong enough. Perhaps you kind of fall into a slightly dull state. You don't know what's going on. Right? But please don't flog the cow. Give the cow a few carrots instead, right? The carrots are much more powerful sources of inspiration than the stick. So keep the stick away here. And find the carrots. What is it that your mind likes to do? What is it that you enjoy? What is it that is nice? What are the nice thoughts that you can use in your meditation? What is a nice way of sitting so you feel really at ease, right, and relaxed? Enjoy yourself. The carrot is by far the most powerful thing. And if you find yourself getting into habits, just change something. Don't sit down so much. Do more walking. Just go for a walk in the forest. Sometimes by just walking in the forest and just walking around and kind of just looking around a little bit. Right? Nature is peaceful. It's not going to disturb you very much if you walk around in the bush around here. And it's quite beautiful around here. Lots of beautiful trees, beautiful forest, lots of nice things. So go around and feel inspired. And sometimes you understand what the fault is. Because suddenly, this is what happens. If you don't force yourself, if you allow things to be, inspiration suddenly arises. And you feel, wow, you feel inspired by what's happening. Then you understand, now I know what to do. And you come back and you sit again. So find that happiness. Don't allow habits to take over. Always search for the reason why things don't work. And gradually, you move out. It's so important to inspire oneself, right? To get into that joy and happiness. And then the meditation becomes actually very, very easy. As long as the joy and happiness isn't there, there is a limit. After a while, you get bored. After a while, you get dull. After a while, you get restless. It is the glue that is missing, the glue that keeps you going for a long period of time. Sometimes it takes a long time. It takes years of practice, right? It takes year after year after year. And gradually, you feel this emergence. It's like you are emerging from this grayness of life, this ordinariness, emerging into something more bright and brilliant. It takes time, but when you see that you are emerging, when you see that you're cutting all the fetters that are holding you back and down, and the mind is kind of lifting off, taking off by itself, it is really worthwhile, right? You get this feeling, I'm doing something that is absolutely worthwhile with my life. Everything else fades into by comparison. It is so powerful when you see this spiritual progress. You're becoming lighter, you're becoming kinder, you're becoming more mindful. You're like emerging into the present moment, right? Wow, this is just so wonderful. So allow that time. Look back sometimes. Look back. What were you like a year ago, 2 years ago, 5 years ago? And what are you now? Have you changed? When I look back like that, I get a lot of hope because I can see things are heading in the right way. And hopefully you're getting the same thing. See how you have changed, right? Get inspiration from comparing yourself with the past rather than comparing yourself with where you think you should be. That is always a bit disappointing. I should be here. But you shouldn't be there at all. You should be exactly where you are. That's the whole point. So the fact that you're heading in the right direction, wow, that should give you encouragement. So investigate. Try to figure out what's going on. Do things differently. Enjoy what you're doing. If you can. If you can't enjoy it, at least be at peace with things. You're heading in the right direction. So I'm not sure if I answered the question, but anyway, that's all you are getting for now. So, okay. Dear Ajahn, chanting. What language did the Buddha and monks use for chanting? Pali or something else? Okay, so first of all, I don't think they actually chanted. I think chanting might be slightly the wrong term for what the Buddha and the monks did. It's more correct to say that they recited the suttas. And maybe that's what we should call it now as well. We should say that we are reciting the Metta Sutta in the morning. Maybe that is a better thing to do. But they recited it. For them, it was that was an oral tradition. Everything was transferred orally from one generation to the next one. So it was recited to keep it in mind, right? Orally. And then went from teacher to student, generation to generation. And the language that the Buddha used, nobody knows exactly what it is. It is very similar to Pali, right? We're talking about small differences in dialect. If you can imagine, Pali came into existence maybe a couple of hundred years after the Buddha. Now, if you take the English language and you read English of 200 years ago, So I don't know who the authors are about around that time, but Charles Dickens maybe 150 years ago or something. So if you compare English now with English 150 or 2 years ago, 200 years ago, you will see that it is still very much the same, right? It's quite easy to read people who wrote 200 years ago. If you go back 300 years, it gets more difficult. 300 or 400 years, it gets more tricky. But a couple of hundred years ago, the language hasn't changed that much. And we can assume that it's exactly the same thing with Pali compared to the language of the Buddha. The changes would have been quite small, quite insignificant. It's not really a different language. It's just an evolution of the language that existed in North India at that time. I mean, English has probably changed much more, right? English has been a global language. English has been under the influence of so many different types of languages, so many different types of culture, right? It absorbs words from here, absorbs words from there. English is this incredibly flexible language. It's always changing, always morphing. It is quite likely that Pali was much more rigidly preserved, or that language in North India was more rigidly preserved than English is today. So that is so roughly you can say it was Pali, although that is not quite true. It was that's a kind of ballpark answer. Two, was Pali came roughly 300 years after the Buddha? Yes, you can say that Pali existed in the period after Ashoka. There are lots of inscriptions that can be found in India, and from those inscriptions you can have some idea what the language was like in India at the time. And it's interesting that the inscriptions that are found in India in the 100 or 200 years after Ashoka, they are found in vast areas of India. They are probably some of the most similar to the Pali language. So it's quite likely, quite possible, that Pali was derived from that language that existed then. And that would have been 200-300 years after the Buddha, roughly, say 300 years after the Buddha, approximately. Yeah. So quite close. In some cultures, monks chant in Pali, where listeners don't understand a thing. What's the use of chanting in Pali? Is there any spiritual value, healing, or ability to penetrate into unseen beings? What's the point? Well, the point, you know, always remember all of these things. It's about the effect it has, right? So if you like listening to Pali chanting, maybe you have grown up in a Buddhist culture, and because you have grown up in a Buddhist culture, you're used to hearing Pali chanting, and when you hear Pali chanting, you feel kind of peaceful, right? It makes you feel nice. That's good enough. That's fine. Then it has a purpose. As long as it has some kind of purpose, that's fine. So this is one reason why we chant in Pali, because people feel good about it, and then they can meditate afterwards, and it kind of improves the meditation practice. Even better, of course, is if you understand what is going on. That's even more powerful. So if you can understand these things, I always think that it's nice to chant in English, so we know what's going on. But sometimes you can just learn a few words of Pali, and by hearing those few words, it can be enough to give significance to what you're listening to. But certainly, the idea, of course, with the chanting, with the recitation, ultimately, it is to understand, right? It is to grasp what's going on. And if you keep on reciting something like the Metta Sutta in Pali or in English again and again, and you try to investigate the meaning of the words, you try to understand what is going on, after a while it starts to sink in, it starts to have more meaning. Every time you recite it, it goes in a little bit more deeply. And then you kind of remember it in daily life, right? And then it becomes a force for you. The same thing, sometimes we do the chanting of the recollection of the Buddha, Itipiso, Bhagava, Arahang, Samma, Sambuddho, etc. And again, it's nice, it's quite a short chant, so there you can actually understand all the Pali words. And if you understand all the Pali words, and you understand the significance, what they're pointing to, the meaning behind them, that's actually very powerful, very, very powerful. And you get the feeling for who the Buddha is. What is the Buddha? You know, what is it that is so significant about his awakening? And then you, you know, with the right attitude, you feel a sense of joy that there is such a being in the world who has understood the human condition, who understands fully about happiness and suffering, right, fully, and that he's there to teach us and say, this is what I have seen. I have discovered the reality of these things. Here you are, I'm giving it to you for free. And all of this, I'm giving it to you simply for your happiness and for your benefit, for no other reason. Right? When this starts to kind of penetrate, it's like you get goosebumps because it's actually very powerful and very beautiful. Of course, understanding the meaning is the ideal way of doing this. What do we miss by chanting sutras in non-Pali languages, such as English, Arabic, Russian, Hindi, Latin, Sinhala, Tamil? Okay. What do you miss? You may not miss all that much if the translation is a good translation. Maybe chanting in Russian is perfectly fine. But of course, sometimes the translations aren't all that great, right? So you have to know that the translation is acceptable, all these kind of things. I know that for many translations around the world, they don't actually translate from the Pali. They take the English translation and translate from English, right? So then it's like two levels removed from the Pali. And of course, for each level you remove, the more it becomes like Chinese whispers, right? The more kind of, after a while, you don't even recognize you can't recognize what's going on in the translation anymore. Yeah. So, because every level there is some degree of interpretation, some degree of choosing the right word, and every time you can get more removed from the original. Yeah. So that is the good thing about learning Pali, and for this reason, I feel that as a monastic, it's great to know Pali. It's wonderful, and it allows me to go deeper into the suttas. But a lot of the English translations that are available today are actually quite good. Translations by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi actually are quite excellent. And if you use those, you don't really have to learn Pali. I wouldn't recommend lay people to learn Pali. It's just too time-consuming, right? To learn Pali actually takes quite a lot of time. Unless you are an absolutely brilliant linguist, in that case it might be a good idea, but the vast majority of people are not brilliant linguists. So I would say it's good enough to read the suttas in English. Has there been any direction from the Buddha about the chanting language? Again, reciting language, the Buddha actually says, says in the sutta, that we should really do it in our own language. That's actually what he says. And I think that is one reason why I am very keen on doing things in English. I think it's a great thing to do. Learning Pali is useful, but doing it in one's own language is so important. And there's something about when you hear something in your own language, it goes in quite deeply sometimes. When you hear it in a foreign language, it's not quite the same. Sometimes when I read things like sutta translations in Norwegian, and these days I'm not sure whether my Norwegian is any better than my English, but anyway, it's when you read it in Norwegian, there's something about because you grew up with Norwegian, I spoke Norwegian as a child, it kind of has sometimes a power, right? A kind of an emotional resonance with you that any foreign language never really has. So because of that, I read it in Norwegian, I think, whoa, this is actually what it means, right? Now I kind of get more of a feeling for what is going on. So I think it's very useful to hear things in your mother tongue so that you can it can go in more deeply in that sense. And I think that this is what we should be doing. This is one of the reasons I decided not to chant the Ittipiso on this retreat, but just to chant the Metta Sutta, because that is what we have in English translation. Okay. Dear Ajahn, under right action, why isn't abstinence from consuming toxic substance included? Thank you. That is a very good question. It is one of those kind of strange things that you find in the suttas, that the mention of drinking alcohol is not very all that prominent on the path of the practice. It's not incredibly prominent. It occurs in a few places, but all kind of the mainstream descriptions of the path that don't actually include the consumption of alcohol. And I think the main reason for that is because the drinking itself is not necessarily a very bad thing here. It is how we behave as a consequence of drinking that is the problem, right? So the suttas, what they do is that they say this is bad action, and then it's up to us to draw the conclusion that, well, if I drink too much, I will be doing these bad things, right? It's okay, so I better not drink alcohol as a consequence. That is kind of the point there. So the point is the unwholesomeness is actually how we act as a consequence of drinking, not so much in the drinking itself. But it is certainly interesting that it's not there so much. And again, I think that is the reason why that is the case. But remember, I even though that might be the case, I certainly don't recommend anyone to drink because of that, even drinking in small quantities. Because one of the dangers of drinking is that it's very habit-forming here. Right? I know so many people in the world, they use alcohol to be able to relax, right? Because they live very stressful lives, and then when they come out home in the evening, they always have something to drink to be able just to relax. And that is very dangerous. Once you use alcohol in that kind of way to relax, it's a kind of dependency on something which can really take you down the wrong track. And of course, far too much consumption of alcohol leads to terrible consequences in the long run. So please don't think that you are in charge of these things, that you can drink a little bit and that's okay. I think it's important to kind of cut these things out altogether because they are dangerous, and that is why they are spoken about in the suttas at all. And remember also the thing about, from a Buddhist point of view, that you take these habits with you into future lives, right? You have it in this life, take the habit with you into the future life. Continue drinking in the future, and then you might not have anybody around to tell you it might not be such a good idea. So it's always good to create those good habits right away, right now. Okay, I've got to go a bit faster here. Okay. Dear Ajahn, in my old age, I have been offered a place to participate in medical research at the University of Western Australia. Any others who would like to do the same, given below is the contact telephone number. Okay, only condition is one should sign the agreement to donate your body upon death. This is once in a lifetime opportunity. that's a good point. It really is a once in a lifetime opportunity. That is very, very true. Please join. Thank you. Okay, so this is the contact number if you want to sign up for this medical research at UWA. So maybe we can hang that up on the board somewhere, and then people who are interested can join. So I'll just put that to one side. Okay. Dear Ajahn, it is said now and again that the Abhidhamma was not told by the Lord Buddha, but subsequently added long afterwards. In fact, very logically, comparing the Pali language used in the Abhidhamma to other texts, it is said that it should be like Shakespearean to Harry Potter. However, or whatever it is, isn't the content of the Abhidhamma more important than the period it was written in? Things like Patavi, Apo, Tejo, Vayu, analysis itself draws attention to very basic facts of analysis of the elements. Please enlighten us on this. Thank you. Okay. I think that is exactly how I would say. It is very clear when you read the Abhidhamma in the Pali. I have not read the whole Abhidhamma, but I have read extracts here and there. It is quite clear that it's a very different language from what you see in the suttas. The way of expression, the vocabulary, the style, everything has a different feel to it. You feel that you are in a different era of writing, basically, or of composition, if you like. Yeah. I don't think there's any doubt about that. So the question is, isn't the content what matters, rather than the time it was written in? Well, the point is that in Buddhism, the most important thing of all the teachings that we have in Buddhism are the teachings of the Buddha, right? This is the most important thing. The basic assumption as a Buddhist is that what the Buddha taught must be correct. the Buddha must have known what he was talking about. If the Buddha didn't know what he was talking about, it kind of everything falls apart, right? So we have to assume that the teachings of the Buddha, they are the real thing. So if we know what the teachings of the Buddha are, that is where we should find most of our inspiration. So that is really the point here. The Abhidhamma, remember, we don't know who wrote the Abhidhamma. We don't know where it comes from. It is very likely to be a text that has been added to and expanded over a long period of time. The very root of the Abhidhamma probably goes back almost to the time of the Buddha, because there are things in there that are very similar to the things in the suttas. And they are even said to be the sutta analysis compared to the Abhidhamma analysis. You find that in a text called the Vibhanga in the Abhidhamma. So it actually gives you, this is the sutta analysis, and then it gives you, this is the Abhidhamma analysis, and tells you these are different. Right? So, but because we don't really know who composed the Abhidhamma, we don't know whether these people knew what they were talking about, whether they were Aryas, whether they were just scholars, right? Usually what you find is that people who like to compose big, complicated things are usually not the Aryas. The Aryas, they might compose a few little things, say a few little things, but normally they just like to kind of meditate and they don't like to get into too much scholarly activity. That is my experience. So because of that, it is quite likely, quite possible, that many of the things in the Abhidhamma, they were composed by ordinary people, right? Maybe very intelligent. Maybe a lot of the things they're saying is spot on, is right. But we just don't know. And it's actually very hard to know. And there are things in the Abhidhamma, especially in the kind of later things like the Abhidhamma commentaries, etc., that, to my mind, conflicts with what is in the suttas. Now, if I see a conflict between the Abhidhamma commentary and the sutta, then, of course, I would go with the sutta, because that's the word of the Buddha. Perhaps it's just my delusion. Perhaps there is no conflict, because perhaps it's just me. I misunderstand what's going on. But I like to trust my own judgment. I don't think that's being arrogant. It's just being, you have to trust your own judgment. There's nothing else to trust in the world. So you have to trust your own judgment in that sense. So that's what I do. And I say, well, this doesn't seem to match. Okay, so I go with the Buddha. That is how you think about these things. And it's actually quite important to realize that when we talk about the Abhidhamma, usually we don't talk about the Abhidhamma Pitaka. The Abhidhamma Pitaka is very kind of dry and incredibly, doesn't have all that much meaning on its own. It's when we talk about all the other stuff, the commentaries on the Abhidhamma, the sub-commentaries, the Abhidhamma manuals, right? And we kind of put all of this together. That is what we normally call the Abhidhamma. It's like a very big mass of literature, all kind of combined into one, that was composed over perhaps a thousand years or something. That is what today is known as the Abhidhamma. So, again, the suttas have everything we need to reach awakening. Why go to another literature which may be or may not be relevant to what we're doing? I think it's enough to focus on the suttas. Very often people start studying the Abhidhamma, and the Abhidhamma is very complicated. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of effort. You think a lot. You contemplate. How does this work? And very often all you're left with is this kind of dry feeling, this dry of some kind of intellectual thing that has been built up that doesn't really relate all that well to your practice. That's often what you're left with. Anyway, that's what I feel left with when I read a little bit of Abhidhamma. I don't read much of it, but whenever I read it, that's kind of the feeling I have. So I would not recommend studying the Abhidhamma, because I don't think personally it is all that useful. Okay. Okay, unusual point, perhaps. It seems clear to me that in the suttas about not trading in poisons, as Buddhists, how do we apply this to everyday life? I've discovered many poisons being sold in foodstuffs, cosmetics, cleaning products. Even medicines are often containing chemical toxins and mercury preservatives, for instance. Even plastic often contains BPA, which is a poison. How mindful should we be about the poisons in our food, chemicals, herbicides, poisonous pesticides, etc., etc. I think the thing that you see in the suttas is poisons that is deliberately aimed at killing people, right? There might be things in foodstuffs and everything which are not ideal and which might be poisonous if you have it in large quantities, but it's not deliberately meant to kill people. So I think it is right. You're selling poisons that are going to be used, like you're selling chemicals to somebody who's going to start a chemical warfare with them, right? That sort of stuff. Here is 10 tons of this really nasty chemical. Please use it for whatever dodgy purposes you're going to use it for. That kind of thing is what is bad. So it's really the intentional killing of living beings through poisons that I think is met in that particular place. Yes, if you want to take it beyond that, of course you can. So that's really up to yourself and how you feel about that. Do we know anything about the Buddha Gautama's wife and family, children, etc.? Did they become enlightened too or receive merit? I'm curious because my mother became quite angry when discussing the Buddha's responsibility to his family. Thank you, and with metta. Yes, this is a classic thing. This is the Christians are famous for going around and saying to the Buddhists, oh, that Buddha, he was a bad fellow. He left his wife and child behind. This is a kind of classic argument that sometimes you hear. But it is interesting that, again, and this is why it is so interesting to actually read the suttas. You read the word of the Buddha and you realize that argument is actually false. This idea that the Buddha kind of left in the middle of the night, he got onto his horse called Kantaka, and he rode and he kind of jumped over the city walls and this splendid city called Kapilavatthu, and just seeing his wife and son asleep before he left. All of that is just mythology, it's just legend. It's the legend of later Buddhist understanding. But in the suttas, what does it say? In the suttas it says the Buddha left his house while his mother and father were crying, right? They were weeping and they wished otherwise. So what's going on? Well, what is going on is obviously the Buddha has told them, right? I'm going to go. That's the only way he would know that they wished otherwise, right? And they were crying because he was leaving. So obviously the Buddha had spoken to his parents. Presumably if he had spoken to his parents, he had made arrangements for his wife or his son or whatever that was, so all of those things were probably sorted out, right? Just a little bit of reading of the suttas shows you that some of these legends, actually there is no basis in fact. They contradict what the Buddha himself says he did when he left the household life. So according to later sources, when it comes to the Buddha's son, we know from the sutta that he too eventually reached awakening, Rahula, right? There are a number of suttas where the Buddha speaks to Rahula and encourages him on the path. And eventually he is supposed to have reached awakening according to the suttas. The Buddha's mother, or to be more precise, the Buddha's foster mother, Mahaprajapati Gotami, she is also known to have attained awakening. There's many suttas where she is talked about and the Buddha gives her special instructions, right? And she, according to the Pali Canon, she was the first woman to become a bhikkhuni and to establish the bhikkhuni sangha. Whether that is historical or not is a little bit uncertain, but anyway. So that's the son and the mother, right? And then the Buddha's father, Suddhodana, that is a bit more unclear. There isn't any clear much information about Suddhodana in the Pali Canon at all. There is one place in the Vinaya where the Buddha goes back to visit his family and he meets his father. And his father says to him that when the Buddha allows Rahula, allows his son to go forth, then his father says, oh, you know, when your son goes forth, the pain kind of cuts to the bone. But then now that you are also getting my grandson, the Buddha's son, to go forth, it cuts even deeper. Please, in the future, make sure that you ask for the parents' permission before a child is allowed to go forth into the homeless life. So that is the background story for why monastics these days always have to ask their parents to be allowed to go forth. So that is the Buddha's father, and there isn't much else said about the Buddha's father, so nobody is really sure what happened to him. I'm sure he he seemed to be respectful enough to the Buddha, so probably he did well as well. That's just my guess. Rahula's mother, the Buddha's wife, actually we don't even know whether the Buddha had a wife. There is no mention of a wife. The only mention there is in the suttas is of this a woman called Rahula Mata, which quite literally means Rahula's mother, right? It doesn't say that they were husband and wife, so it is very unclear who she was. According to later tradition, her name was Yashodhara or Yasodhara, but this is later tradition, not actually found in the suttas. And according to that later tradition, she went forth, became a bhikkhuni, and she became an arahant. But again, all of this is later, and it is not entirely sure whether that happened or not. But perhaps that happened. If it happened, then the Buddha certainly looked after his family to the absolute limit, right? As high as you possibly can look after your family. I would say he took full responsibility. Actually, that story I was just telling you about the Buddha's father, Suddhodana, that story is actually when the Buddha starts off with the Buddha coming back to the Sakyan capital, the Kapilavastu. And when he comes back, Rahula's mother, who is not named, is just called Rahula's mother, she says to Rahula, to her little son, "Go and ask your father for your inheritance." Right? Interesting little thing. Go and ask your father for inheritance. So this little boy, he's only 8 years old or something, he goes up to the Buddha and says, "Give me my inheritance." Right? Quite sweet. And the Buddha turns to Venerable Sariputta and he says, "Ordain Rahula." Right? It's quite powerful, isn't it? Because what is the real inheritance? The real thing that the Buddha can give him, if he wants to give him real happiness, is to ordain and to actually practice the path and become an arahant, which he does. That's the real inheritance. Give him the highest possible. I don't think that wasn't, of course, not what the mother had in mind, but anyway, that's what happened. It's a nice little story for you. Okay. Okay, dear Ajahn Brahmali, you mentioned that you will teach us metta loving kindness meditation later on. Will you be able to teach us death contemplation meditation later on too? Thank you for a wonderful retreat. Yes, death contemplation is always part of my retreats. I always bring that in there. I think it is a very important part of meditation practice. And the Buddha said everybody should do death contemplation. So maybe we can... I'm not very used to incorporating these things into the guided meditation, but maybe we can try to incorporate it into the guided meditation as well. We'll see what happens. I make no promises. Okay. Dear Ajahn, ill will. How do I remove ill will towards my neighbor whose big trees are hanging 80% over my roof? This costs me much money and to get people to clear the gutters. Oh, that is a big one, isn't it? That is oh, yeah. Well, basically you're going to have to forgive him. You're going to have, this neighbor, whatever it is, whoever it is, whatever kind of dodgy things that he has done, and he's not listening to you and refusing to take off the branches or whatever. In the end, you're going to have to forgive. You cannot control other people, right? This is one of the things on the Buddhist path. We want to control the world. We want to control everyone, everything. This is kind of so deep-seated in our psyche, and it all comes from the sense of self. The sense of self wants to control. This is one of the basic things you start to learn in Buddhism. You just cannot control things. You cannot. And very often, you have no choice, but you have to let go. You just have to let go. In this case, you may have to let go of a little bit of your money as well. That's what you are saying. Sometimes you don't have any choice, right? So, unfortunately, that is the reality. Of course, maybe if you are wise, you can persuade your neighbor. I don't know if he is one of those people, who is persuadable. Some people you cannot persuade, they might be very stubborn. But maybe with the right attitude, maybe over time, if you reflect carefully on how to be able to persuade them, maybe you can say, you know, I will share the cost with you. We're cutting down the branches, something like that, right? In the long run, that might be cheaper for you anyway. Do something smart like that, right? Do something nice to him. Say good morning every day. Good morning, how are you? Nice. So what a wonderful thing to see you today. Something like that, right? Don't just pretend. Do it in the with your heart. Otherwise, it doesn't work. Yeah. And so there's always ways, right? But please don't get angry with them. They are just human beings. They have a different viewpoint from what you have. They are caught by their own conditioning. They don't understand that they're causing you so much suffering, right? Please don't get angry here. They are just, you know, they're humans, for goodness sake. Of course they do stupid things. It is to be expected. Please forgive. It's a minor thing, right? Branches hanging over your house. It's such a small thing. It may seem big, but actually, I think it is quite, to be honest with you, I hate to break this, but I think it is quite a small thing. Yeah. So try to sort it out. These things can be sorted out in a nice way here. Possibly. Okay, because the branches are hanging over my roof, she does not need to do anything about it. Council law. Okay, to remove them, I have to pay, okay, each year for at least 10 years. She maintains her position and rights. What can I do with my ill will? Okay. Yes. Okay. No, she is not totally unreasonable. If the branch touches the neighbor's roof, she will get them removed. Hard to meditate on this, on the good side here. Okay. Well, this is the other thing. And remember that if you cannot meditate on the good side, this is coming up in the sutta later on, if you really feel that the person is, you know, has so many negative qualities, then you should have compassion instead. Somebody who has a lot of negative qualities, they are creating lots of problems for themselves, bad karma, all kind of things. Nobody really likes them. There's very good grounds for having compassion for such a person. They are deluded. They don't understand what's going on. Compassion is the right way here. Okay, good luck. Okay. Dear Ajahn, I have heard about this sutta long time ago, and it was translated, but I'm not sure whether it was a better translation. It was about something like how the world started and some floating living beings and how they started to get defilements, etc., etc. Do you know about the sutta? Yes, it's called the Aganya Sutta. It's in the Digha Nikaya, number 27, I think it is. So if you go to Digha Nikaya 27, you can look that up on the beautiful tool that Ajahn Sujato has created called Sutta Central. It has all the suttas there. So go to suttacentral.net and you will find all the suttas there in Pali, in English, in every conceivable language, like you were saying before, Russian and Tamil and whatever. If so, could you please briefly describe the sutta? Okay. I can try if I can remember this, because I haven't read it for a long time. But essentially, the sutta, it starts off with beings living very long lifespans, and they are, it says there, they are feeding on joy, right? Piti bhakka, feeding on joy. That is their sustenance. All they need is joy to sustain their lives. This is a bit like the jhana realms. That's what you do there. All you're feeding on is joy. No material sustenance is required. It's great, isn't it? Feeding on joy. Sounds very nice. So feeding on joy. But then after a while, things start to change, as always, right? So things start to change. And then night and day starts to appear. And the stars appear. The sun appears. And the earth appears. And the earth has a certain crust to it, right? And these beings, they see this crust. And one day, craving, now they're just feeding on joy, there's no craving. One day, craving arises, or the idea arises in this being. I should check out this crust, right? It looks quite cool. Let's check it out. So it goes down to this crust on the earth, right? And it breaks off a piece. And it tastes it. Wow, delicious, really nice stuff. And craving arises in this being. This is how sensual desire arises, right? And then the story is how that sensual desire then becomes coarser and coarser and coarser. And the more refined type of crust disappears and more coarse things appears on the earth. And with every every time craving for the more coarse things arise, so the craving becomes more coarse, the being becomes more coarse, they are not so beautiful anymore, they lose their self-luminosity, right? And everything goes gradually downhill, downhill, downhill. And this perhaps is like a parable of what happens to ordinary beings. Unless you have a spiritual path, unless you have something to hold you up, the general trend for us is to always to kind of gradually slide downhill, to become more and more indulgent, to crave more and more. If you indulge your cravings, they always give rise to more craving. There's no stopping. There's no end to craving. The only way to end craving is to halt it in its tracks and to understand that it's dangerous and it doesn't work. If you indulge craving, it just gets more and more. There's no end to it. And that is why you get this continuous downward slide. And of course, it goes down and down. And eventually, it tells us how basically our modern society has been created out of this kind of downward slide, right? And eventually they have to appoint a ruler because people start doing immoral things, right? Like lying and cheating and all these kind of things. So they have to appoint a ruler, and that becomes then the Kattiyas, right? One of the castes of India, the ruling caste, that's how they arise. And this is how all of this society comes into existence. That is kind of the idea behind that sutta. It's like a mythological sutta, but I think it makes a very good point of this tendency for defilements to always increase unless we do something to check them, unless we set up barriers to these things. So that is a rough idea, but please have a look for yourself, because it is interesting. Nice little sutta, actually quite a long sutta, a nice long sutta. So have a look and see what you think. Yeah. I think it is 27. Digha Nikaya 27 is called the Aganya Sutta in Pali. If it is not 27, check out 26 and 28 either side. Yeah. It is very close. It is not far away. So, yeah. Okay. I'll do one more question, and then maybe we'll call it a day after that. Ajahn, if all beings were to achieve awakening, denouncing sensual pleasures along the way, would this not lead to the end of life, or at least to human beings? Who would reproduce? This is a common question, actually. You get these questions quite commonly, so that's fine. This worries me. So for the sake of humanity, I might just give in to sensual pleasures. Yes, that is wisdom in action. You don't have to worry about that, right? There are the vast majority of people. How many people are actually really willing to give up sensual pleasures in this world? It's a tiny, tiny fraction, right? It is so small. It's infinitesimally small. There's no need to worry about life dying out. And if it were to happen, if life were to die out, it wouldn't be a big deal, right? Everybody would be happy. Remember, awakening is a happy thing, right? It's not some kind of miserable thing that you don't want to do. If everybody could be much better off, if everybody in the world could be fed, if everybody in the world could live in peace and harmony, wouldn't that be a good thing? Or do we want to keep the wars going? It's a bit like saying, oh, I prefer to have the wars going because, that's what I'm used to and I like to indulge in a bit of ill will. It's a bit like saying that, right? Moving towards awakening is a positive thing. If everybody could be awakened, hooray! This is a wonderful thing, but it's not going to happen anyway. So regardless, you have nothing to worry about. So either way, I'm afraid that I don't think that is the right way of looking at it. Anyway, I'm not sure if you meant this in jest or what, but this is the kind of thing that people sometimes think. Maybe that is because you're on retreat, right? Sometimes the mind wants to think about all kinds of stuff. And that's what sometimes happens. Anyway, I'm going to leave the rest for tonight. It's already past 9 o'clock. And then we can finish off the rest tomorrow. So see you tomorrow morning. Yeah.